Welcome to this edition of the Million Dollar Mastermind Podcast. This is where we pick the brains of high achievers from all walks of life and get their hard-earned, real-world insights on winning. I'm your host, Larry Wydell.
Hello, everyone. We're talking with Ben Askins, and he's kind of the leader, one of the leaders of the new generation of leaders around the world making a mark in business. So welcome, Ben.
Wow, that's quite the intro. Very nice to be here.
Yes, sir. And you've traveled a lot of roads, made a lot of progress in your early career in business and in reputation, contacts, dealing with global brands. And I'm sure you've picked up a lot of valuable insights about what the way the world works and the way the world doesn't work and how to be successful out there. Because, you know, it's a big company, all the way down to individuals. The principles of winning and making the right choices come down to a lot of the same principles that work consistently over time. And the quicker you can learn those things, the quicker you can start being productive yourself. So when did you get started on your entrepreneurial business leadership type adventure? What was going through your mind at a young age that sent you in this direction?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I do get asked that a lot. And I'm kind of what I'd call an accidental entrepreneur in a lot of ways. So I was all set to go down the sort of more traditional job route, as it were. So at university, I did work experience, found this insurance company, which I quite enjoyed, did a little bit of work there, and they got offered a job at the end of college or university. And I was all set to do that, moved to London, and then the company was bought that I was about to join. And so kind of left with nothing to do. So sort of had already moved to London. And then I met a guy called Chris, who was my business partner of my first business. And he sort of said, look, I think you're doing this thing. And I said, that sounds absolutely amazing. We couldn't have had less of a clue, but we decided to start a digital marketing agency. So I was 22 at the time when I started this. So we decided to start a digital marketing company that essentially provided marketing for luxury and premium brands. And so we set out a stall, had a tiny little office, and slowly grew it over the next 8-9 years, really.
Did your partner have experience in digital marketing?
No, neither of us did. So he had sold a few websites to make a bit of money at college, and I did Latin and Greek at university. So our experience on the digital front was absolutely diddly squat, and we had nothing whatsoever.
How do you go from diddly squat experience and track record, plus you're young, to getting deals with these global brands, Jimmy Choo and Claridge's and these big global brands, the Aston Martin, Omega, Mayburn Hotel Group? How do you go and get your foot in the door there to do marketing for them? Seems like they would have shown you the door.
Yeah, well, I think the lucky point we had was we were so low down that the only way was up. But essentially, we started off by doing things quite small. So when you have no experience, no background, no nothing, you've got to build up credentials. That's kind of step one. So for us, we were young. Money wasn't an issue for us at all. So we're very fortunate there, had no dependents, had nothing like that, very much on a student budget. And so the opportunity we had was to build our credentials. So we started off by doing work for free. So we'd go around and say, look, we'll do the free work for you. We'll give you a website. We'll give you marketing support, whatever it is. And in return, all we ask is you give us a shout out on your socials, you give us credit on the website, et cetera, et cetera. And we used that first wave to kind of build out our initial set of clients. And then off the back of that, we started to leverage those clients to start charging people initially, which was a very exciting moment. We still remember those first paid jobs, and to slowly start building out the support from there. So every sort of raft of clients would then fund the next round or next step up from a sort of size-wise. So you don't go from nothing to Aston Martin, but you start off with like small blog sites. You then start work with small businesses. Then you start working with medium-sized businesses, and slowly you sort of build out your portfolio that way. So there was no sort of real trick to it. It was just slowly identifying who we wanted to work with and slowly sort of building up our raft of clients from there, really.
How did you get the idea that would even work? Where did that come from?
Yeah, so, I mean, to be honest, it was our only real option because we were young, we had no experience, we had no real skill set. And so we kind of had to do it that way because genuinely there's no other reason why someone would work with us. So we had to do it that way. It was our only choice. But we'd understood, you know, we had a good understanding of like how people would work. We'd seen a couple of agencies in our space be sold just before we started and all of that sort of thing. And we just used that to slowly leverage it and build it out from there. And so it kind of was our only route to success, really.
Yeah. So the point there is seeing a living, breathing model you would like to be yourself really gives you a head start towards patterning, building those patterns, because you can see it happening before your eyes and you see that it works because they're successful. And it's easy to believe that this could pay off for you. Was it frightening at that time? What kind of emotions do you go to? Because you went to that and you went through that to where you were starting to be able to build. And how long did that take, by the way?
So we sold at the 2021. So it was about a 9-year journey all in. We sold Verb. It's interesting. I was never afraid in the early days. I think I was so clueless. I didn't know enough to be afraid. If you ask me now, I am a lot more scared in my entrepreneurial journey I am today than I was at 22. What you want to make of that psychologically, I don't know. But I'm a lot more aware of the decisions that I make. I guess it comes, you know, you go from incompetently incompetent and things like that. And for me, I was so incompetent and so clueless. I didn't know enough to be afraid. Whereas now I'm far from the finished picture, but I have enough experience to recognize that some decisions I make do have wide-reaching consequences. So I'm way more afraid now than I was back at 22. The one big advantage we have was we're a service-based business. So I always say this, a lot of young entrepreneurs say, you know, what should my first business be? I always say, get in the service base because you don't need investment, you don't need funding, you don't need anything to get up and running. You can bootstrap it hard. Because if you're young, you often don't have the credentials, you don't have the appearance to kind of people trust you with money to fund a company. You have to bootstrap it. It's very rare you get funding, or certainly funding at an acceptable deal. And so I always recommend a service base, like a digital agency, like a sort of, well, any sort of service base, because that's the best way to get your foot in the door from an entrepreneurial perspective.
And one thing that you did right that I like to point out was you did not look for a handout or someone to come bail you out. You didn't like stay on the dole and wait for other jobs to the economy to shift and jobs to come back. You went on the, you figured out this is our only option. No one's going to bail us out or solve our problem other than ourselves. And you dove right in. What do you think caused you to have that up, take charge type approach?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it goes back to, you're weirdly confident when you're young sometimes. You really are. I'm like overly confident, I would say, in a lot of ways. And I think for us, it was just a case of, it sounded fun. It sounded interesting. It sounded exciting. And when you're young, those emotions matter, right? Well, like I said, go back to when we had no dependents, no why, nothing that we were completely free in that sense. You know, we're very lucky. I think it's one of the advantages of being young when you start a business is you don't have the pressures of a mortgage and all of that sort of thing. And so I think when something gets exciting, you're really happy to work hard on it. And so for us, it wasn't a sort of negative perspective, oh, what are we going to do? Our backs against the wall. It was like, no, actually, we really want to do this. And we think, I never thought we were crazy, right? No one thought, you know, how's your little business going? How's your little company? Oh, how's your little whatever? Everyone used the word little for the first 2-3 years of our journey. And it was only after we kind of began established that people started to recognize what we'd built. So I think people laughing at you is a big motivation, like wanting to prove people wrong. I remember a couple of networking events early on where agencies who were much bigger than us would sort of go, oh, you know, they treat you like the kid brother, right? Which was nice in a certain way, but gets quite patronizing quite quickly. And so that was always a driver for us, just being that and super, super competitive, I think, which you have to be in this sort of world, really.
Where'd you get the competitive streak?
Having 3 siblings and playing a lot of sport when I was younger, I suspect.
Playing sports at early ages are great trainers for so many things you need later in life. Learning to work with a team, learning how to deal with defeat, learning how to compete in a game situation with the clock running, getting behind, coming back, taking charge. And I find that a lot of people who they go through their formative years without being in a competitive situation of some kind of at a disadvantage. It's almost like prepares them to be an employee, because when you're out there on your own, you got to compete. You got to find that fight inside yourself. And it sounds like those, your networking events did you a big favor by putting you in front of people that could kind of hold you in contempt and let it be known they didn't think much of you.
Yeah, it does. And those little things have an impact. You know, I still hate networking events. I mean, I don't know many people who love them, but even now, and I think it probably does go back to those few early car crashes where we would go, you know, very proud of our business and people would just completely ignore you, basically. Where it's interesting, you know, so I still don't like networking events. So I do find it interesting how those early lessons in your career really do stay with you. So now a lot of the sort of rules and guidelines that I set myself very much come from either horrendous mistakes I've made or experiences where I felt particularly powerful, either positive or negative emotions, and basically just never want to sort of go through that again. So yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I think sport for me has always been an outlet. I'm one of those people, if I want to de-stress my long day, exercise for me has always been that thing for me. And I find running incredibly boring, if I'm being honest. So for me, team sports is the natural answer to that. So yeah, I totally agree. And growing up with brothers and an active family, it stays with you for sure.
When you say rules and guidelines and I set for myself, what's the first thing of those that would come to your mind?
Yeah, so the first one is every Sunday without fail, I clear my inbox. So my inbox is my to-do list. I'm very strict about what emails I respond to and what emails I get CC'd in and all that sort of thing. And that comes from the early days of the business where I completely lost control of my inbox and I felt like I was drowning under messaging high quick enough and all that sort of thing. So for me, I sort of decided that every week I start Monday morning with a clean inbox. That's just what I do. And it's just how I center myself, how I get ready for the day. And I don't think I've ever missed that. I really haven't, even if I'm on holiday, you know, whatever it might be. So that's like an obvious example of something I do every week without even thinking about it. It's just, I won't be able to sleep as well as I could if I didn't do that. So it's just stuff like that, which sort of get ingrained in with you where, because a lot of people go, oh, you've got to like be disciplined. I agree and I disagree with that. I think discipline comes from something that's naturally ingrained with you. If you're always working on discipline, I don't think you have discipline. I think discipline, you train your body to do it, that you just almost do it without even thinking. And that's kind of always been my view about things like that.
I couldn't agree more, because it's like you grow into these disciplined behaviors automatically from an internal desire to, you see ways of making things easier for yourself or less painful for yourself or to offload stress. And you wind up doing it because you realize this is going to make my life easier. And so you're not doing it because of some commitment you made to discipline or to obey the rules. You're doing it because this has got a payoff for me. And I'd rather do that than not start the week under the gun with a pile of emails hanging over my head. And so that's a great point.
And I think you have to be smart about it as well. I mean, another good example is I hate morning meetings. Always have. I've never always struggled to get going in the morning. I've always done late nights. I always have. I find it easier to work in the evenings. Things a bit quieter. I get a lot of my thinking done then. And so I kind of set my day up for that. I try and get a lot of the sort of easy tasks out in the morning and know that I do my best work after lunch. And that's not, I don't know, would you call that discipline, or would you sort of recognize that that's just me understanding how I like to work, what's best for my business, and going through the motions like that?
I think that's one of the keys to being successful for a long run. You develop an approach to life and business and projects that suit you, that you have discovered fits you, and where you can be the most productive. That's the whole idea. How can we get ourselves to be the most productive? And have the best attitude too, you know, when you go into these networking events of, you know, that this always puts me in a foul mood and that I'm going to go to it. You find the things that put you in a good mood, and people put you in a good mood. It's situations, you design the systems. And I think that's where a lot of good discipline kind of comes from.
For those of you who are sick and tired of fooling around and are dead serious about wanting to move up fast, I've got something especially for you. I've combined the best insights from over 40 years in business and making $70 million in income and compressed them into a free webinar. That's right, it's a free resource. If you want to find out exactly what the concepts are that I use in coaching Million Dollar Earners, register now at WeidellOnWinning.com. You'll discover the 5-part framework used by so many to reach their financial, personal, and professional goals. You can find that link in this episode's show notes.
Now let's talk about how you got your, talk about some of your first big breaks in the, it's one thing to start a business, be able to make a living, get paid. Hey, we got paid. But then when you get some big breakthroughs, it's like, hey, we could be big at this. It's not, we could just, you go beyond, we could be successful at this. We could be big at this. We're getting some really powerful recognition clients. Where did some of those big breakthroughs occur for you in that, what'd you say, 9 years of that stage?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I can pick 3 or 4 clients which were moments for us. And I recognize a business on moments. I don't really look at time. I look at stages. And individual clients kicked off the new stage for us. So there was one, a very early one, we did a lot of free work for like these bloggers. And this blog, one blogger just took off. She just became unbelievably famous. It was one of the most visited websites in the UK. And that wasn't really anything to do with us. That was a huge break for us because we'd done nothing beyond build the infrastructure and done a little bit of the marketing. But actually, it was all her who kind of blew up. but she absolutely blew up. Everyone saw our website and we started to get huge inundates from brands saying, oh, we really admire this person. And that was our first big break, because it was our transition from like small blogging, small businesses, to first proper businesses who wanted to kind of work with us. The next one was a brand called Bugatti. So that's obviously a famous car brand. For us, that was a really iconic moment because we beat out a lot of these big players. We kind of established, we were always like the sort of the young agency sort of scrapping for it. And that's the first time we went up against the big, big agencies in the UK, and we absolutely wiped the floor with them. Because I think you get to a point where if it's a huge opportunity for you, it's less of an opportunity for people who are a lot bigger than you. And that's your opportunity, right? You can take it more seriously. You can put more hours in. You can make a lot bigger effort. And so for us, I think our big breaks were recognizing those moments where you say, oh, if we got this one, that's a new level for us. That's where we really sort of go into this next sort of stratosphere of what we're aiming for. So I think for us, it was two or three clients along the way that sort of symbolized a moment where from there we grew very, very quickly, or had a huge growth spurt off the back of that client, because we're always very good at leveraging wins into new business. And that was one of the few things that we did quite well. There were many things we did terribly, but that was one of the few things we did really well, was leveraging our success to kind of build on that and to get go bigger and better the next year. And so I think for us, that was one of our big moments for sure.
It sounds like you found that the extra effort you put into the preparation showed up, that the client, when you did your presentation, they could tell who was taking this more serious than the next person. And that's really an advantage an up-and-coming firm has that you don't think about, do you?
Yeah, I think there's two things I always say to people when I go into these meetings. Is one is people really care. If you've made an effort, that goes a hell of a long way, because people can feel it, they can see it. And if they feel like that you're taking them seriously, it makes a huge difference, as opposed to someone who lazily puts something together. It feels very templated and things like that. The second thing is how much they like you. It really does make a difference. I always say this to people, in the sense of how you make people feel carries a hell of a lot of weight when it comes to business decisions. Like, you think it doesn't. You think every company goes, we have an amazing procurement process. We always make these decisions on X, Y, and Z factor. But it is amazing how much it comes down to, I just get a good feeling about these people. I like these people. And it could be the most technical, scientific decision that with all the templates, and I've sat in those meetings and people fill out forms on whether this company's good, and they give them a mark and a score. But it is amazing how much it comes down to, how do you make people feel about you? And if you get people excited about something, if you get people feeling good about it, that carries a hell of a lot of weight in business, because it's a personal relationship, even for these big tech digital companies.
I think that's a big point, Ben, that they're big companies, but they're people at big companies, and relationships matter. So much of business and life is who's likable and who's not. It's like, who gets the job? Who's elected? Who are the voters going to? First sort you can do is like, who's the most likable candidate? And maybe they're both dislikable, but you say, who's the least dislikable? But you know, that those people, those relationships, those likability, it's amazing how that comes down to something as basic as that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. But it also kind of makes sense, because these relationships, you talk to these people a lot. If it's a big client or a big piece of work or a big project, you have to talk to people a lot. And so people are sitting there going, if I'm going to spend the next 6 months of my life talking to this person 2, 3, 4 times a day, why not pick the person who makes me laugh, or I quite enjoy, or I find quite interesting, or I find quite easy to talk to, or all those sort of things? So it makes complete sense when you actually break it down, even though it sounds wild when you say these massive, because a lot of companies are quite faceless, right? They go, oh, it's BT won this account or whatever it might be. But actually, people make those decisions. People find you, exactly like you say. So yeah, I mean, it kind of makes complete sense. So I always say, like, never underestimate just building a nice relationship with someone, because God, that above that gets you quite a long way.
What did you learn about business and being a success in business as you got exposed to bigger and bigger and more successful companies? Did you notice things about how they went about their business and find things that you can incorporate or that inspired you?
Yeah, I think the trick when you're, so it's amazing how often you see an entrepreneur, he starts a business, it goes very well, it gets to a certain point and the company just stalls. And you know why it stalls. It's always the entrepreneur and it's always the founder, because they've not let go. I think the delegation element for us was absolutely key, because we realized very quickly on, there are some things we were very good at, some things we could manage to do, and some things we were just awful at. And the best thing we can do is to hire people to do those bits we're awful at and to delegate, so you can focus on the next level. And so for us, like, getting, I remember there was a year where we stalled a little bit, and it was because we were trying to do everything and we were a bit worried about investing in the future and we were sort of holding fire and hiring a few key positions. And then we just thought, no, this is ridiculous. Let's take a slight hit. Let's hire to these positions. Let's focus on growth. And we had our best year ever. So the delegation element for us, I just can't overemphasize how important it is, and recognizing you can't do everything. You're certainly not good at everything. And if you allow yourself to be a bottleneck, that's the quickest way to stall a business.
When did you co-found Gaia, the green technology company?
So I co-founded that. So I sold my business in 2021. I had a 2-year earnout where I worked for the company who bought us for 2 years. And so I founded Gaia at the end of last year. So we launched formally, end of last year.
Now this is a software company, is that right?
It's a green technology company, which is a completely new space for me. So my first business, Luxury Digital Marketing, my new business, Green Tech, it's very different. But for me, it represented an area I find absolutely fascinating, because green tech is one of the most fraught, like politicized, argumentative spaces you can be in, or certainly the green side, not the technology side. And so for me, I found the whole input, and I find the arguments that people have around these conversations completely flawed. And I really do. I think there's way too much pressure on the consumer. And I think there's nowhere near enough pressure on governments to make these decisions, because it's very easy to go, oh, businesses are evil and they're just ruining the environment. And I go, well, hang on, it costs a lot of money to just change things voluntarily. That's just not how anything works. The second thing I say is, everyone always goes, oh, why is the CEO not just prioritize the environment? I said, well, if he did that, he'd be fired by the board of directors by lunchtime. So you can't just do that. It has to come from government, and it has to be sustainable from a financial perspective. But the argument I really dislike is, I've never understood this logic of, oh, you either pick the environment or financial success. There's obviously a space in the middle where you can make something sustainable work, but also make it a financial success. So we set up Gaia to essentially fulfill the promise where governments roll out new climate and green laws and regulations, and we build products that allow companies to achieve those rules and regulations. So we're a SaaS-based business, and we've got a couple of different products. But yeah, it's a really interesting space. I've had a lot of arguments with a lot of different people around. It's a very heated discussion, and I'm sort of circling the middle, sort of trying to herd cats into the center to kind of recognize that everyone's kind of arguing about the same thing, but everyone's so impassioned about it that no one's really listening to each other.
How do you evolve from those involvements to where you've developed such a big voice for become a champion of the younger generation in the workplace, where you have such a wide following of 500,000 people across a variety of platforms talking about companies, managers, making money the right way? How do you go from that kind of background to that kind of influence?
Yeah, so it started off, I was starting to see some so I'm obviously, my first business was digital. I'm fairly abreast of the social platforms. I understand how they work. And I was seeing this weird trend of bad business advice. And obviously, hypocrisy of me saying this whilst on a podcast, but I think the sort of podcast approach to business damaged things, where people realized that basically what happened was a huge raft of people decided that instead of doing the hard graft and actually starting a business and making it a success, you could just rent a podcast room and pretend you've done it. And you start throwing out these sort of weird business advices. And there's a group of people in particular who were just offering this really poor advice, but they had hundreds of thousands of followers. And so it starts off quite accidentally. I would just like re-watch some of these videos and just react to them and explain why they were wrong, basically. And it kind of built from there. And then people were starting to message me about their like work bosses, and they complain about their work and their bosses. And for me, when the more people you have, the more important like motivation is. And for me, I've always genuinely believed that if people like their job, if they're motivated, if they've got a vision, if they've got good leadership, if they're kind of up for it, if they're paid competitively and all that sort of thing, your business does better. It just does. But it's amazing how companies think, and companies agree with me, but then still go out of their way to kind of, in a really basic way, hack off their team through some really basic mistakes. Like, and we're talking some big hitters as well. I heard this amazing one where one of the big four firms here in the UK had a big pay rise. They gave all their juniors a pay rise, and the partner who announced it said on the call, I don't think you deserve it, but here's your pay rise. I mean, obviously you're just, the only reason we're doing this is because we have to because of the market, because I don't think you deserve it at all. And you think, my God, you've just unmotivated a whole team by giving them a 20% pay rise. That's the most idiotic thing I've ever heard. Like, what are you playing at? And so I just started to read out some of these stories and explain why I thought they were wrong, what I think a business should do. And I think people think I just like hate bosses. Like, I don't hate bosses. I just hate bad bosses, because I'm a big believer in, and it's amazing, I sit in front of these managers and I say, do you think people do better work if they're happy or if they're not happy? And they go, happy. Okay, then talk me through these last four or five decisions you've made, because it looks like you're actively trying to make them quit. So I'm always a believer of give people a good environment, because I think it's the right thing to do. But I also am a big believer in that genuinely helps your business, because I've run a company with a motivated team, and I've also run a company which had unmotivated team in stages. And let me tell you, it was a hell of a lot easier when they were motivated and up for the fight, really.
What platform do you make these, let your opinion on these situations? What, you write a blog, or you put on LinkedIn, or what platform did you using to where the word got out about?
So TikTok. Yeah, no, TikTok was the big one. I do post on other platforms now, and I'm starting to launch new channels. But yeah, TikTok was the big one for me. So I think in about 8 months, I jumped to 650,000 or something.
Really? And how long would these be? You in video talking through something? Is that how you would do it? Very simply, low tech?
Yeah, just camera set up at home. I have a guy who helps me with editing. So yeah, once every 2 weeks, I'll film a batch of these stories and people send me the content. That's kind of what's amazing about it. Is it really, in a weird way, it's kind of more low effort now than it was at the start, because people send me stories. And so I just read them out and react to them. But it's amazing. The power of the personal brand, I've been quite amazed by in the last year, because my videos get about 25 million views a month now, which is more than a lot of news channels. Like, it's amazing how much these brands can really help grow your business, but also you sort of get your voice out there and you know what you stand for and what you believe. So it's been a journey these last of 8 months or so, for sure.
25 million?
Yeah.
Oh, these are numbers that are just hard to relate to, aren't they?
Yeah, it's wild. And you think it's just, and like, can you imagine a stadium of 25 million or a, you know what I mean? Like, think how many people that is. It's hundreds of thousands of hours of people watching me just kind of rant about bosses on. It's wild. It's a whole new world out there, and people in the States, it's Australia, it's South Africa, it's not just the UK. So it's been kind of wild when you actually break it down and think about the numbers.
But, you know, that's kind of like more than all of the people in all of the stadiums of all the games of the World Cup or something.
Yeah. And think about what, like, yeah, well, think how much it costs to attract 25 million viewers to a TV show, for example. Or, and this is just simply me and my video editor just talking in the kitchen of my flat, basically.
How long are these videos? What have you found is the most effective length for those TikTok videos?
So TikTok as a platform is definitely pushing longer form content. So TikTok started off like 10, 15 second, like fun reels. They're definitely moving in on sort of Instagram and YouTube and sort of take market capital, and that kind of push towards long form content, YouTube in particular. So about 2 to 3 minutes long now each video.
Okay. And so 2 to 3 minutes would be the long form. And are you finding a better response from those than you had earlier on, or about the same?
Definitely. I think people do just buy into, I mean, I do different types of content, but one, I talk about worst bosses and read a story out. Those definitely do best. I think it's important to try new things. You know, I posted an 8-minute one once and that did very well. So it's good to mix it up. But yeah, definitely the longer, the better. It seems to be going that way.
Actually, amazing that anyone could have that kind of spread or that kind of impact. And you said 8 months, all of this is a recent phenomenon?
Yeah, so I start, well, maybe nine now. I started end of March last year. So nine, I guess now.
Really? Now, how did you get recognized by Forbes? Was that for your digital media work, like top under 30 recognition there?
Yeah, so that was for my first business, Verb. So we were the class of 2020. So me and my business partner, you know, very honored, but we were assigned the class of 2020 for marketing, which was, yeah, a huge honor for sure. It was a very nice moment.
Does something like that, how big of an impact does something like that make? Does that lay the groundwork for, give you credibility as you start your green technology company, as you start with TikTok? Are these things all pretty much different?
Yeah, so I always describe it as moving the boulder. My second business is a hell of a lot easier. I mean, it's hard in a lot of ways, as all businesses are. It's a new space. But the knowledge that I have from my first business makes it so much more straightforward. And the profile I have, we raised funds for this first, for the second business. And the reason I was able to raise funds was because I had the credentials of the first business. You know, I would never have been able to do that for my first company. So yeah, it makes a huge difference. And it's about getting the boulder, removing, you know, the hardest point is day one, day two, day three. Those are the hardest times. The hardest pound to win or the hardest dollar is those first few that you win. And it just gets easier and easier and easier as soon as you get the ball rolling. And that's not to say it's ever easy, because I think that's the wrong word, but it gets easier. And so for me, it adds credentials, things like that, for sure. It's obviously a nice gratification for myself. It kind of tells me I'm on the right track, which I think is important as well, and kind of keeps you motivated. But I think it was a moment for sure. You know, we describe moments. I think people sort of recognized that was a moment where everyone went, oh, wow, they've got an actual business. That's not just a little hobby side hustle, whatever you want to call it. That's a legitimate business, and it's being recognized by a famous publication. So it was a very nice moment for sure. But I think those moments are important, because I think entrepreneurs in general are quite bad at recognizing how far they are. Because, and it goes back to everyone trying to win the week 1-0. They sort of go, oh, this week was good or this week was bad. It's like, actually, no, in a week, you'll have lots of small wins and lots of small losses. And as long as your wins outnumber your losses, you can take that as a win. Whereas if you kind of put it all or nothing, you're going to end up disappointed in a lot of weeks of the year, I'm afraid.
One little specific question about TikTok posts. How often are you posting? You say once every 2 weeks you get together and do a batch of these. How often do you roll them out?
Once every day. And that consistency is really important. If anyone's looking to grow on social, step one is just being consistent and not being too fussy, because your first content, I'll just tell you now, even if you're really proud of it, your first few efforts are going to be terrible. I look back at what I did 9 months ago and it's just cringy. It's so embarrassing. But I don't delete them, because I think it's important to kind of recognize how far you've gone. And I've no doubt I'll be sitting here in a year saying, looking at posts that I did this week going, well, that was embarrassing. I can't believe I was doing that. So there's a great phrase that I love, which I can't remember, one of the big marketing firms came up with, was you can't do your 100th without doing your first. And I really do buy into that. Sometimes you just have, there's no perfect time to do something. There's no perfect way to do something. Sometimes you just have to get cracking. And I'm a big believer in that philosophy.
And it's really hard to be good at anything until you do at least 100 of them.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
I learned that early on. And now, when did you start your newsletter?
I started my newsletter end of last year, towards the end of last year, yeah.
So that was before the TikTok adventure.
So no, so it was just after. So since TikTok's kind of blown up, I've started to establish new channels. So my newsletter's one I really enjoy doing, actually. I do like writing. It's not something I get to do too often at the moment. So I send a weekly newsletter giving career advice out to younger generations.
And what do you do? Are people, you're responding to messages that people leave for you, questions they're leaving for you? You're just a Q&A type thing?
Yes, you sort of start to find your voice. But essentially what I do is I pick out one of the stories that someone sends to me and establish a theme from that. And then I write a piece about, go to a little bit more detail, try to give people more exercise. I'm a big fan of practical advice. I think it's very easy to just say like, oh, quit your job or just do something you love and throw out cliches like that. But actually what people need is, here are the three ways exercises I do to work out what you would like to do. Or here's the process you should do to actually quit your job. It's things like that, which I think practical advice is often lacking online. And so my newsletter is my way to try and fill that void a little bit.
Yeah. And how do people get on your newsletter?
If you go on my LinkedIn profile or any of my social platforms, you should see the link there, and you click on that and you can subscribe straight away, and it's completely free.
Yeah. Fantastic. So where are you speaking from today?
I am in London, where I live, just south of the river in London.
Now, you have an affinity for Greece for some reason. And you speak passable Greek, as far as I understand. Where does that affinity come from?
So I spent 10 years of my childhood living in Greece. So when I was 2, my dad's job took us out there. So I lived there till I was about 12, 13.
Yeah. Any aspirations to living there more permanently in the future?
So, I mean, Greece, we go there every year with my family. The Greek islands are by far and away my favorite place on earth. It's just one of those locations that just feed your very soul. The food's amazing. The people's amazing. It's not a place I don't think I will, certainly not in the near future, I will live there. But it's a place I will never not go to, because I just find it the most incredible place on earth, really.
I've never heard the phrase, the Greek highlands. I've heard the Scottish highlands.
Sorry, the Greek islands, not the Greek highlands.
Okay, island. Yeah. I was going short-circuited there for a minute, yeah.
Yeah. The Greek kilts are not what you'd like.
Right. Well, I appreciate your time. I wish you the best in your new adventure. I'm looking forward to circling back and touching base with you in the future, because I feel like you're going to learn a lot of things. You're going to help a lot of people. And what would you say is the main pain you went through, or sacrifice, a price you had to pay? There's always a price you have to pay for success. What would you say, you look back, what is the biggest price, sacrifice, painful type things you had to force yourself to go through Or maybe you went through no choice of your own. It just happened and you had to endure it. What would you tell people?
It for sure is my personal life. I lost contact with friends who I'd been friends with since school. I lost contact with a lot of family. And I actually made a conscious decision to course correct. So it was about 5, 6, 7 years in, me and my business partner, we recognized that actually, you know, although we were on paper very successful from a monetary perspective, actually, we both recognized that this wasn't long term, it wasn't worth it. And so for us, we made a conscious decision to spend more time with friends and family and all of that. And we've never regretted that decision. Even if you knocked a little bit off the valuation of the company, we decided that actually, because there's success, right? But what's the cost of success? And I think what the cost is an important decision and a question to ask yourself, because people go, I want to be a millionaire. And you go, okay, would you accept how many millions? How few millions would you want if you also got to do this and this with your life and enjoy that part? And if you'd be happy and all that sort of thing. So the cost of success is something I always get people to think about, because I've lived and breathed it and I know how important it is. So for me, I was quite lucky. I was able to course correct and save some of those relationships where I lost contact, but there were some I didn't. And that's the price I've definitely paid. So for me, I do think about that a lot and recognize the importance of carving out that time for you as much as it is for your business.
Great words of wisdom. I wish you nothing but the best. Ben, do you have any parting insight to pass on for all of the up and coming high achievers, motivated people who've been listening to us?
Yes, the working life has changed forever. And the entrepreneurs that are going to be the most successful are the ones who accept that and not try and keep it to the way things were. I think the next few years are going to change how we recognize work-life culture and work-life balance and what people want from their jobs. And I think the entrepreneurs and the businesses that are the most successful are the ones who are going to embrace that rather than just fight it.
What would the big distinction be in someone who embraces that versus someone who doesn't?
COVID tore up the rule book, right? Working from home and establishing remote working changed the rule book on how businesses work. And I'm seeing a real trend at the moment of, and a disconnect between teams and like what bosses and entrepreneurs and founders want. And people want, founders and entrepreneurs want people in the office. And a lot of people don't want to be in the office 5 days a week. I'm a big fan of hybrid working. I think that works best for all involved. But the businesses that are going to struggle are the ones who don't recognize that the world has changed from what you were used to. And I think for me, the advice I try and give is the best entrepreneurs in the business kind of embrace change and go with the flow. If you try and fight it, you always lose out in the long run, I think. And so that's kind of my parting thought, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, it appears to be a losing game to fight the way the world is headed. It's hard to win that fight by yourself. It's better to get yourself in the middle of where the momentum is and let it work for you rather than against you, I think. Ben, I wish you the best.
Exactly the same.
I'm amazed at your following.
Likewise, it's lovely to meet you.
I'm excited about what you've learned so far, and I'm excited about how you're using it to impact other people in a positive way. So early in your career, and so I know that's going to pay big dividends for you, so congratulations.
I really appreciate that. That's very kind, and thank you so much for having me on.
We'll look forward to talking down the road. Thanks so much.
Looking forward to it. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Million Dollar Mastermind. If you felt there were any valuable takeaways from this episode, please take a minute and leave us a 5-star review. Your feedback is important and really helps us get the word out to a wider audience. Remember, we have a valuable webinar that is absolutely free. Register for it right now at whitealarmwinning.com. Thanks for listening.